Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's presentation, Closing the Book, Incorporating Improvisation into the Piano Lesson. Hopefully this will be interesting and a new topic for you all to sort of delve into. If you have not gotten a handout, I have some over there. They're designed to go with this presentation, as well as the PowerPoint that you see about. I've designated places for you to write and jot some notes down. Should you have any comments or questions about the material, write them down, and hopefully at the end we'll be able to take some questions. Improvisation is traditionally associated with jazz musicians, pop artists, contemporary praise and worship bands, and people who just seem to play by ear. On the other hand, for classically trained pianists, the concept of improvisation is in many cases viewed as a separate facet of musical training, if incorporated at all, and it's often deemed as just a natural talent or a gift, rather than a skill to be developed. However, this has not always been the standard. In fact, some of our best examples of improvisation come from some of our greatest musical forefathers. Composers like Bach, Clementi, Scarlatti, Mozart, and Beethoven are among many who were taught improvisation alongside of their piano technique, music, as well as their composition lessons, and they in turn taught it to their students. So during those days, the concept of improvisation was viewed as an essential skill to cultivate. It was heavily relied upon for church positions, and it was also a great source of entertainment at private concerts. So, beginning, here's a somewhat historical example of how two of the greatest musical minds included improvisation. Well, technical difficulties. It worked just a few minutes ago. That's okay. The video that you were going to see was a probably not super historical example of Handel and Scarlatti having an improvisation battle of sorts, where they just sat for a while, and it's actually a recount of Handel looking over his life, and one of his competitions was with Scarlatti, and talking about how he won this private little concert. I guess it was a competition. So that would be an example of Baroque improvisation. So they would go for long periods of time improvising on a given theme, or just something that they had come up with themselves. And it was just a great source of entertainment. So, as you can tell, facility on the keyboard without every written note out was not something that keyboardists dreaded. It was just simply another way to create music. So, today there is by and large a great divide between the lessons where classical music is taught and those that incorporate improv techniques. It's typically an either-or situation, but not usually both. And this polarization of sorts does our students a great disservice because there is so much to glean from these techniques. Not only is this concept valuable in creating well-rounded musicians and multi-talented musicians, it's also of crucial importance in developing independent musicians. As teachers, we hope that we're laying a solid foundation for our students to understand the basic concepts of music, such as notes and rhythm, phrasing, and dynamics. And as they progress, we want them to be able to take these primary elements of music and start to make musical decisions and inferences on their own. And improvisation is a way to help students develop this higher order thinking skills that are necessary to perform music with a greater depth of understanding. But how do we do that? How does the typical, though highly skilled and savvy, independent piano teacher teach a concept that they themselves are not fluent in? This is the snag that we typically run into, the hit. This part makes us uncomfortable, so we just sort of skip it and glaze over it. And oftentimes it's this problem that is the barrier from keeping us from inviting new ideas into our students' lessons and progressing in our skills as teachers. However, that does not have to be, because fortunately, we are not alone left to our own devices trying to come up with ideas on how to jazz up Schumann's The Happy Farmer or improvise on a theme of Minuet in G. No, because for the past several years, there has been a surge emerge in the concept of teaching improvisation in the piano lesson. And pedagogues across the country are coming up constantly with innovative ideas on how to implement them in the lesson. With website games, apps, and method books specifically geared towards these concepts, teachers have a wide range of tools to choose from. In particular, the works of Scott McBride Smith, American Popular Piano, as well as the works of Forrest Kinney, Pattern Play, and Chord Play, offer insightful step-by-step lesson plans designed for teachers and students of all skill levels to use. So tonight, I will be examining a few of these areas, key areas of these methods, as well as demonstrating a brief overview of what these lessons could look like. I've also compiled a bibliography of helpful books, articles, and websites for use in the studio. With this presentation, I hope to at least begin to bridge the gap between the traditional lesson and these not-so-new ideas. I'll touch on a few of the basic elements of improvisation, as well as give examples from some of today's most comprehensive method books to show how teachers without formal training can incorporate them in their lessons. And so hopefully you'll begin to see that this concept is accessible for all musicians, regardless of skill level or prior training. My goal is to have my students be comfortable and to have fun with the basics of improvising, to create relevancy in their lessons, and to connect a classical repertoire that they are learning in my studio to the music that they listen to, and to use the concept of improvising to help them have a deeper understanding of the music they play. By developing these skills, I hope my students will be on their way to becoming independent musicians. Finally, my target audience is primarily the independent piano teacher, the people just like me who have little to no experience in improvisation. So I hope to give a few useful tools to incorporate into your private teaching and to give confidence to those of us who may think that these concepts are beyond their reach. So what is improvisation? Actually quite a simple concept. But in order to begin teaching improvisation, we need to have a clear understanding of what it is. So improvisation can be plainly stated as the art of thinking and performing music simultaneously, making spontaneous music without the intent to revise, the in-the-moment expression of musical images that directly reflect the immediate ideas, emotions, and sensations of the improviser. So it's a fairly simple concept. As I stated earlier, it's not a new concept developed by jazzers of today, and methods that incorporate improvisation have been around longer than might be assumed. One such method that incorporates improvisation is Orff Schulwerk. Created by German composer Karl Orff, the Orff approach to music education guides students through several phases of musical development. So the first phase that it starts with is exploration. Students discover the possibilities available in both sound and movement. So they have free range of the instruments. And they're just exploring what they do, the sounds they make, what interests them about them. And they're encouraged to be curious and to follow that curiosity. Secondly, the next phase is imitation. So students develop basic skills of listening to their teacher and imitating what they hear, sort of in call and response. They use basic skills like body percussion, finger snapping, thigh tapping, foot stomping to do this imitation to understand rhythm. And then they do call and response games with their teacher, and these can incorporate singing back and forth, as well as playing the non-pitched Orff instruments, as well as the special Orff instruments that he specifically tuned for this, as well as melodic instruments such as recorders. So simple instruments to help understand imitation, the concept of imitation. The next phase is improvisation. So students develop these previous skills to the point where each individual is confident in initiating this in a group setting. So they take these call and response games, and they're student-centered now. So students start these call and response activities, and they're comfortable enough and understand it enough to internalize it and to be able to implement it themselves without having to involve the teacher. And finally, that last step is creation, which is combining all of these skills developed in each of these phases and putting them into an original context. So some of these forms may include small binary or ternary forms, rondos, theme and variations, or something like a mini suite that students can incorporate these their ideas into. So within a musical structure. So ORF pedagogy takes what the students know and continually moves it into a new place. It takes their already formed concepts of music and what they understand about it, and by teachers' careful questioning, they're encouraged to explore the concept a little more and a little more each time. Part of ORF's success is this underlying characteristic of freedom, the freedom to choose, the freedom to choose and improvise and create within a given structure, a structure such as pulse, meter, or musical form. So students' musical knowledge is built through these explorations of different form and musical instruments and sounds and the way these sounds are produced. As well, teachers also experience this freedom when developing strategies in an ORF curriculum because they're encouraged to be imaginative in their creation. The more imaginative the classroom is, the more engaged the students are. And when our students are engaged, the more primed and ready they are for learning. So ORF employs fundamental improvisation techniques such as imitation, echo, ostinato, can and canon to create music. And these techniques are developed to considerable depth and complexity as students grow in their musical knowledge and understanding. Well-known ORF teacher trainer Doug Goodkin explains that what separates the ORF approach from the other music teaching methods is that the experience of improvisation is at the heart of the matter. Developing children's ability to improvise and compose using musical elements such as rhythm and melody, harmony and texture, and so forth are core principles of an ORF approach to music education. So improvisation is one of the core elements of this famous approach. Another well-known method that uses improvisation as one of its core elements is the Dalcroze method. So when people hear Dalcroze, they think eurythmics, which is the internalization of music and rhythms as demonstrated through movement. However, it's actually a threefold focus on eurythmics, solfege, and improvisation. So the first portion of Dalcroze is eurythmics. And proponents of this method believe that rhythm, melody, harmony, dynamics, form, and phrasing, all of those elements can be learned through movement. So what eurythmics is the connection of the body to the ear to music. Dalcroze begins by having students react to what they're hearing rhythmically through improvisation or improvised movements and gestures. So they hear music, they respond physically to music, and in the process of responding, they learn about music. They begin to internalize and understand it. The second portion of the Dalcroze method is solfège, do, re, mi, etc. Solfège is used to enhance the sense of musical pitch, as well as the ability to distinguish between tone qualities. It also helps students develop the ability to listen and retain tonal memory, and is used to prepare the students for note reading. So that's the second portion of the Dalcroze method, and it helps students understand intervals and what they sound like, what they feel like with their hand motions, and what it's like to sing them, etc. The next focus is improvisation, and the purpose of improvisation in the Dalcroze method is to allow students the freedom to express their musical ideas without the need to think too much on prior music material. According to Dalcroze himself, improvisation in some regards can be the hardest of the three facets to teach. However, he also says that once students have had a fundamental, firm grasp on the first two elements of eurythmics and solfège, it can come quite naturally to students. So after students have a basic understanding of piano technique as well as a fundamental knowledge of music theory, they're given short improvisation tasks to complete at the piano, which encourages spontaneous music expression. So Delpros sought to create a style of music education where the rules of theory and musical style are so natural to the student that he does not need to rely too much on the process of thinking. They've truly internalized the concepts. Instead, having internalized these rules, the student is much freer to express musical ideas without the need to constantly reflect on the mental lists of rules that we typically think we need in order to create music. So these previous examples give evidence to the validity of learning through improvisation, but what do studies show are the benefits of improvisation? Why is it important? How is it beneficial to incorporate some of these techniques into our students' piano lessons, into our skills as teachers? Well, research has a lot to say about this. As we've learned and as we've talked about, teaching our improvisation to our students is not new, but was rather a common tradition among musicians of Western cultures until about the mid-19th century. Similarly, music of non-Western cultures has always included some form of improvisation. According to Bill Dobbins, who's a professor of jazz studies and contemporary media at the Eastman School of Music, our general neglect of improvisation as a creative discipline stands in direct contrast to the rest of the world, where improvisation has thrived in virtually every cultural region. So this shift away from improvisation began about the late 19th and early 20th centuries because of the increase of literal music performance. However, many works by our famous composers such as Brahms, Chopin, Franck, and Stravinsky almost undoubtedly started as improvisations on the keyboard. Improvisation then found its way back into mainstream music in the United States during the 20th century due to the increase in popularity and growth of jazz music. Now, to again borrow Bill Dobbins' words, jazz uses the most highly developed form of music improvisation currently practiced in the Western Hemisphere. However, the concepts learned in improvisation can be taught in other mediums besides jazz. So improvisation is an important link to our musical past as well as a vital part of music in non-Western cultures. Perhaps one of the most common benefits advocates of teaching improvisation promote is that it's an avenue to give our students the tools necessary to creatively express themselves in a way that is unique to them. To quote an article by Julie K. Scott, like no other form of music making, improvisation allows students to express music in the moment that is uniquely theirs. Improvisation also allows teachers to see their students in a new light and to see how they deal with spontaneity in their own lives. So it's a glimpse into the minds of our students and how they're thinking and what they're thinking and feeling about music. Related to this idea of self-expression is the concept of musical autonomy. Our students feel a sense of ownership in something that is completely theirs. Again, to borrow the words of Doug Goodkin, he states in an interview, improvisation can provide a student with a sense of ownership and pride in his or her work. When a student improvises, all of their lights are on, thinking, hearing, feeling, and doing. And because they're so completely engaged, most students love to improvise. When we help our students develop the skills of improvisation, it places a different value on the music they're creating, and they feel a sense of accomplishment in their improvisations in a way that's different from the music that they're playing on a written page. So when our students value what they are accomplishing and they're allowed to be creative, they are more motivated to continue learning. Another benefit of improvisation is that of interacting musically with others. Students learn so much from each other, and improvisation is a great way to incorporate that. We want our students and our children to be able to work well in groups with others and to be able to embrace teamwork, and improvisation is a great way to incorporate that as well. During an improvisation exercise, in a group lesson, students are encouraged to listen to a partner or another group of performers and react to what they hear. This type of improvisation requires good listening skills as well as communication skills. So some of the studies have shown some of the benefits of improvisation, and they include collective decision-making. So students worked together to make musical decisions and had to finally end up agreeing on something together. So they had to work together to make musical decisions. Also, group identities were established, so people found identity and made new relationships in these groups that improvised. Musical participation was favored over competition with one another to see who was top musician. And finally, risk-taking was celebrated. So sometimes our students get a little intimidated when they're playing in recital. And these studies show that in group improvisation, some of that fear is taken out because they're all working they've all worked together. And it's something that they enjoy and something that they embrace. And finally, being musical together with the group was valued overall. So over everything else, they enjoyed making music together with one another. And also another reason, which is a pretty big reason, students can benefit from studying improvisation in their lessons, is that students who improvise may improve their technical skills, their aural skills, as well as sharpen their music reading ability. So when students take their minds off of the written music and their eyes off of the page in front of them, they are more likely to focus on the subtle aspects of music. Things such as, you know, paying attention to how the sound is being produced, the quality of sound, as well as technical aspects of how to achieve that sound, the sound that they're looking for. Shifting this attention from the notes to nuance helps our students give more detail and more depth to their playing. Improvisation also may help students develop a better understanding of music. Through her research and conducted studies, Maud Hickey, who's professor at the Beenan School of Music at Northwestern, came to the conclusion that improvising encourages students to rely more on their ears to create music and less on notated music. Through this reliance on the ear, she suggests music improvisation helps students to understand music at a deeper level. In the same vein, research results of Eastman professor Christopher D. Azera suggest that improvisation may improve students' music reading as well. In his study, Azera divided a group of fifth grade students into two groups. So students who experienced and took part in improvisation in their classroom music instruction, and students who did not have improvisation in their music instruction. And after this experiment was conducted, the students were given a series of three playing tests that gauged their reading abilities. So through this study, Azera found that students whose instruction included improvisation scored significantly higher on each of these three playing tests that required music reading than those students whose instruction did not include improvisation. These results led him to believe that when improvisation was included as part of their musical instruction, students were able to develop a better understanding of how music progresses harmonically through the mental application of music and the physical performance of music. And this led to a keener sense of musicality. So in short, the ability to improvise seems to be related to a student's deeper comprehension of music, the tonal and rhythmic and expressive elements of music. But why is that? Well, students' ability to express themselves musically through improvising can be compared to the way we express ourselves verbally while we engage in conversation. You and I do not plan all of our conversations out at the breakfast table every morning. We, in fact, most of our conversations happen spontaneously and without any premeditated thought. Similarly, speaking and conversing help prepare us for reading language and enhance our understanding of the written word. So to compare it to speaking, improvisation enhances our performance of notated music because it prepares us for learning how to comprehend music notation. The results of this research by both Hickey and Azera show a strong correlation between improvisation and the success of our students' musical performance, which further validates the notion that improvisation should be a fundamental part of our music lessons. So, as teachers, we are constantly searching for ways to assess what our students know and if what we're teaching them is actually reaching them and if they're internalizing it and if they can apply it in other settings. So, things like, did they really understand that concept of pulse changing and meter and what the role of a half note is in cut time, because they seemed hesitant, and I'm not sure if they can carry that on into another piece besides this one. Those are some, that's an example of some of the things that we go through as teachers when we're establishing new concepts. And a way that improvisation helps this as and helps us as teachers is that it's one of the best ways to assess a student's understanding of a new concept or skill. To again borrow the research of Azira, the ability to incorporate a new concept into improvisation shows that they've internalized it, shows that it's been they're able to understand it and express it spontaneously outside of the concepts that they or the context that they had originally learned it in. By observing a student's use of a musical concept in improvisation, the student can follow up with, or the teacher can follow up with questions about the student's musical intent, be able to ask them, you know, what did you mean, and how do you understand this, and what if you changed it this way, and can you put it in this context instead? And they're also able to assess what still needs to be covered about that concept, and to develop, help students develop new ways to learn it, if in fact it hasn't been completely mastered. So just to summarize the benefits associated with improvisation, it provides historical links to culture and tradition. It allows students to creatively express themselves through music. It provides the opportunity to interact musically with others. It also improves technical, oral, and music reading ability. And finally, it gives students opportunities to demonstrate their understanding of musical concepts and skills and allows us as teachers to assess their learning. So you may be hearing all of these examples of why it's important to include improvisation in our teaching, but feel like it's more than you're equipped to do. And when we think of improvisation as the final product and performance, it is daunting and it seems like a pretty tall order. However, that final performance in any medium is not where music creation begins. John Kratis outlined a clear 7-level learning sequence to break down the process of how to employ improvisation into our teaching. So the first thing he outlines is exploration. This is the pre-improvisational step. So we can try out different sounds and combinations in a loosely structured environment. So letting the children explore. Are letting our students explore. The next step is process-oriented, so having our students begin to audiate and produce these patterns. This is making music for music's sake, so just being able to start to internalize it and understand it. The next step is product-oriented, so students become conscious and able to operate with external constraints. So technique improves and group improvisation becomes possible. The next step is fluid. Students should become fluid. So performance technique is more fluid and relaxed. So playing the instrument becomes second nature to them and it becomes automatic. The next step is structural. Students become aware of the overall structure and shape of their improvisations that they're creating. They can develop strategies for shaping the work as a whole and just decide and make musical decisions of what kind of structure they would like their improvisations to be. The next step is stylistic, which students can work within a style, including given characteristics. So in jazz, they know to swing the eighth notes. The next and final step is personal. So students take all that they've learned in these prior steps, and they make something and they create a style that reflects who they are. So by breaking this teaching down into a learning sequence, instead of starting with the intent for our students to create a musical masterpiece all in one setting, it makes our goal of including improvisation much more attainable. It breaks it down and it makes it a process. So it's always great to have how-to books when we start new endeavors, and it makes our tasks less daunting. And in the realm of improvisation, we're often presented with books on how to teach things like jazz, how to realize jazz chords, and things of that nature. However, in recent years, teachers have begun producing methods that focus on the process of improvisation, and not just a specific style such as jazz and so forth. So now I'd like to take a few minutes to go over two methods that are geared for students and teachers to develop their creative skills associated with improvisation. The first method I'd like to go over is American Popular Piano, created by Scott McBride Smith with music composed by Christopher Norton. This is an 11-level series starting with a primer, and it's been developed on the principles of teaching through current music, or just this, not current music, but the style of today. He used the example of Bach teaching his sons. He taught music that was relevant to their day, not just music of their past. And it is a four-part series that talks about skills, that is broken down into skills book, a technique book, a repertoire book, and an etudes book, which is what I'll be playing out of. The repertoire book is broken down into two facets. There's a lyrical section to work on beautiful tone, as well as an ensemble section where students can play duets and develop the aural skills necessary to be able to play in an ensemble. The etudes book is a two-part series as well, and it focuses on technical aspects of playing and also improvisatory aspects. So they play with a track CD, not a teacher, so I'm going to play, if I can pull it up, a track for you, and I'll show you how this goes. To skip the Scott McBride Smith one for right now, and I'm going to skip to the Forest Kinney one, and I'm going to have Leah come up to help me demonstrate some of these lessons. So if you'll flip, it's the second section of music in your handout. After the girl on the beach. So Horace Kinney has pattern play, and that's inspiring creativity at the piano. And this is a 6-level series that is just geared for students to be able to understand and internalize some of the aspects of improvisation. And it's very, very simple in its approach. So it starts off with a duet. Your copies are front and back. Starts with a duet. Between either teacher and student or student and student, where one of the people will play the duet, the bass part. And so they would just start to establish the beat. And at the bottom of this lesson, this is the first lesson in the book, from level one, there are variations of what that bass part can do. Then the second part is the treble part, and so they give ideas for creating music. This lesson is just on black keys to help students, just give them a structure to work within. Any black key, and then as they get comfortable, they can add the white keys, which would be F and B written below as C flat. So Leah and I are going to demonstrate what this could look like. It's pretty simple. She's just going to start. And when I feel comfortable, I'm going to jump in and play a simple improvisation.
Thank you.
between two people, either teacher and student or student and student. Very simple. It helps to incorporate listening skills that are necessary in order to play. Leigh and I sort of had to coordinate on the spot, when we're ending and we're changing chords. And as you see in this book, the ideas for creating, they're there for students in case they want to be able to read that music. However, if you just tell them, play all the black keys, and if you want to throw in a white key, throw in an F or throw in a B. These are just ideas to get them started if they're in a rut creatively. Next, after students have mastered that duet part and they're comfortable with these concepts, ideally you would have students switch between bass and treble. And then once they're comfortable with both, start to incorporate it as a solo. So some of these ideas, the way this book is structured is to build upon each of these lessons. So you have this piece called, it's entitled The World Piece. And then the second part of the solo is still World Piece, but it incorporates some of the same ideas, but it's just one person. And again, they give variations to their styles. And also, I forgot to mention before, they have the pattern, the established pattern, and they ask you to play, you know, get comfortable playing the pattern, and then whenever you want, move on to the vacation, is how they word it. And this is just an approach that's to gently guide our students, starting to inch them forward into improvisation. So they give variations at the bottom, so some of these ideas, or else your students can make them up themselves. So this is going to be my solo improvisation on the work that we have, Leigh and I just performed. They give you ideas for creating, again, new patterns. If your students are stuck, a lot of times they want to memorize some of the improvisations that they've done before. And we're trying to get them out of that rut of having to have exactly each note perfect. So, and each note the exact same as the time they played it before, because that's not what improvisation necessarily needs to be. So this is just to gently guide them, saying it's okay to change it. It's music, and this is what you're creating. And most of the time, students will very, very much take to this. So any luck over there, Tom, with that? Yep. Oh, perfect. Great. So if you'll flip back. I'm going to now go over Scott McBride's book, American Popular Piano, and then I've given you a description of it. So, how this is set up is broken up into four different lessons, or modules. So, you have modules 1 through 4, and it begins by having the students, it's a very progressive method, it begins with having the students understand and establish the rhythm of the melody of the piece. They have, you know, at first it starts off establishing, paying the backing track of this particular piece with an opening clip that helps establish the pulse. So, Tom, will you play that opening clip for me?
Yes.
So I'm going to tap the rhythm. Establish the pulse. Obviously, in lessons, you would go through each of these A, B, C levels. For right now, for time's sake, I'm going to skip some of those. Going to letter C, students would play with the backing track, again, to just ingrain what we're doing, to slowly help them internalize, you know, the melody and phrasing and rhythm of this. So students would play. Measures of this little etude. And then if you look at measure five, they have just the rhythm and the left hand given. So they give students the free range to be able to create improvisations within this structure. At the very top, they have improv notes of what to play. So play within this small little pattern. And they also have asterisks to use the notes in any order, so getting them, you know, to be creative and to think outside of what they're hearing in the melody and to create something on their own, but within this given structure. Can we see if it will play again? Melodically, there are bigger intervals at the beginning, or the second measure starts off with that, progressively changes. The improvisation will stay the same, and it will just have the left hand notes to sort of give them a base and something to grasp onto, and then rhythm. And along the way, each time they have, you know, questions, probing questions that teachers can ask, you know, make sure you're paying attention. And listening closely as you improvise, does each note sound good with the backing track? It's a pretty loose melodic structure in the backing track, so they can pretty much play anything, but just making sure they're not throwing in any any random notes, making sure they're keeping a steady beat and staying with the track. And they also give improvisation tips at the bottom, which I think is extremely helpful for students to give them new ideas, just in case, like we said, if they get stuck in a rut. Just different tips to play. Same thing in module 3, if you'll turn to the page. The rhythm differs again in the left hand. The left hand is all half notes except for the end. And again, they go through the same progressive step of, you know, just slightly changing the rhythm and the phrasing as well. This time the phrasing is a little longer. And they keep those improv notes still the same. And the structure is still the same, but it just, this is done throughout the course of a couple of lessons, I believe. And it's great because students can also do these things on their own as well. It can be self-guided, so they can do it in their lessons, but they can also practice these concepts at home. And if you'll flip to the fourth one at the back, this is where it changes. This is where it gets the most different. Still recognizable, still the same melody that we have, but the rhythm is a lot different. They add a little bit of syncopation at the beginning. Different rhythms. Left hand, while the left hand still poses a strum beat, so they have the left hand constantly. Still pulsing the same beat, but they have the right hand starting on syncopation. So this is a very progressive method, and it builds on the same concepts, but it takes them a little further each time, and it's different each time, and it works out well because that's what improvisation is. It can be a little different each time. You can change the melody a little bit each time. Makes our students realize that it's okay to change it. It doesn't have to be what they've played before and to be glued to the page. So they kind of get out of that memory trap. But it's great because they still work within a given structure of melody and the given rhythm. So it's structured so they're not just thrown into it and saying, create something. You know, it gives them something to work within. So I'm not sure that that's going to work again, or else I would play it again as well. But if you're sitting there thinking, okay, these concepts are extremely simple, it's because they are. Well, it's because this is level one, but it's because they're simple concepts. Improvisation is not something that we have to be terrified as classical musicians who probably might not have experienced it before. They're simple concepts that can be easily incorporated into music that we play with our students, music of their classical repertoire as well as current methods. So I hope that this is encouraging, and I hope that this has provided some insight into this world and hopefully some helpful tools to be able to incorporate it into lessons. Now I think we have time for maybe a couple of questions, or does anybody have any comments to make about this? Besides the fact that technology is not working.
Could you walk us through the bibliography?
Sure. I sure can.
Any comments in particular?
I'm gonna grab one from over here.
While you're getting that, this girl on the beach, now you say that's out of their level one.
Is that
yes.
The
first one?
It is not the first one in level one. It's about the second one, and then they do progress in level of difficulty.
Is there a prep level to this?
Yes, there is a prep level.
I would just be curious because this is pretty, with both hands going mm-hmm. like this. This
exactly.
is pretty.
Exactly.
Full coordination.
Mm-hmm. And especially when you get into different rhythms, that I'm sure would cause not a problem, but that would be an added challenge for students. But there is a primer level, we just don't have it in our library. So in this bibliography, it's right after the handout and before the music. I have highlighted some of the articles with an asterisk of what I've used in this presentation. Some of the books as well. I have Forest Kinney's Chord Play and Pattern Play. Chord Play is the art of arranging at the piano, and Pattern Play is what you've just heard. Some of the helpful, I believe Dr. Hauser, you wanted me to go over some of the websites. Is that what you had said?
Yes, if you've gotten any hints or
hints?
Well, just any descriptions of them?
Yes. Well, I have some of the things also that I've used, the ORF Schoolwork Association. Mm-hmm. Bradley Sowash's personal website is a great resource with anything creative, to be honest. He has one of the best-selling method books called That's Jazz, teaching students how to play jazz at the piano. He's just a really nice guy. And just very, very much willing to help teachers in their creative endeavors. He has plenty of articles, teaching tips, lots of freebies on that website. As far as some of his Christmas music, just independent pieces and things of that nature. So it's extremely helpful. Another one, I Ear Revolution, I think is extremely helpful. Helps is another good place for creative inspiration as teachers. They have a lot of games, tips for websites, and iPad apps to use in the studio, and just games to help students be creative, to incorporate improvisation, as well as a host of other things to do. I want to skip down to Lila Viss's personal website. She, along with Bradley Sowash, are just very much on the cutting edge of teaching and creative ideas and technology in the studio, as well as improvisation. I mean, that's her core teaching is teaching students concepts in a relevant way. And so a lot of times she finds that's useful teaching it through improvisation. Along with Bradley Sowash, they've created 88 Creative Keys, which is right above. And I have the link to a teacher workshop that they host every summer. It might be twice a year, but it's in Colorado. And it's just a short weekend trip that is designed for teachers who might not be comfortable, or maybe they are, but might not be comfortable teaching improvisation in their lessons. So it's kind of lessons for big kids. It's lessons for teachers to be able to feel comfortable and, again, implement it into their studios. Those are some helpful websites that I have. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm just curious how you got interested in this area of research.
I think it's interesting. A lot of, like I said earlier, like typically in piano, we think jazz and we think of improvisation. And I started taking a lot of music education classes. And they're just naturally geared towards band and choir and the national standards and things of that nature. But as I began to do homework and research and read for that class, I realized that some of those concepts are completely transferable to what we do as piano teachers. And so that's how I started to get interested in some of these new ideas, is taking them from, you know, large ensemble and band and stuff and putting them in a piano lesson. And like I said, in our pedagogy classes, there has been a surge of interest as far as, you know, Music Teachers National Association, and there's been, you know, creative corners and that, where they focus on improvisation, as well as, just publications that, you know, talk about the importance of it. So it's been a long time coming.
In the last weeks and months, there have been reports in the national press about music merchants that specialize in piano going out of business. Mm-hmm. And just anecdotally, when I told some of the large classes that I teach as how many have had piano training, it's small,
mm-hmm.
very small percentage. So what's the future of piano teaching? These are good ideas that you're talking about, but when you have a chance to use them in 20 years from now.
Right. I think that's a really good question. And we want to continue to stay relevant, not completely change the way what we teach, but maybe just retaining the packaging. And I think, you know, making that connection that makes what we do in piano lessons relevant to what they do, not disregarding by any means classical repertoire or music of that nature, but, you know, somehow linking it to what they connect with, whether it be, you know, music that they listen to, or doing things like this, such as improvisation, something that they can take away and, you know, they're interested in performing. If it's classical music, then great. You know, if it's not classical music, we want people to be interested in music in general. And so finding ways to keep it relevant, keep it connected, I think is important for, you know, for what we do as educators and who we are as musicians. So some of these concepts that I talked about, you know, maybe they'll play a role in how we teach and how, you know, we can keep it around longer. Anybody else? Well, thank you for coming.